Welcome back, everyone, to another fun edition of the Rolex Whiskey Passion Project. Today, I have a gentleman on that I've actually never met in person. This is our first time chatting, but he's been just crushing it the last couple of years in the whiskey community and just really doing a great job, and I was super excited to have him on. Without further ado, Zach Johnson, welcome to the show, kind sir. How are you?
Thank you for the invitation. I'm very excited to be here because, as you know, I adore whiskey and I wear a Rolex.
I love that. So you want to tell the audience a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, so I'm the drinks editor for Up Rocks, which is an online publication. It focuses on hip-hop, movie, lifestyle. I focus on the whiskey section. I've been doing that since 2016 now, so 8 years.
Wow.
And yeah, just over those years, I've been able to travel to every other distillery in the world, and I've had the opportunity to sample literally thousands of whiskeys a year. And then I've also become a judge in San Francisco, New York with Tasting Alliance, and IWSC, London, and coming to Kentucky in September, and John Barleycorn. So I do a little bit of that. I do a little bit of consulting for barrel picks and things, as you do when you're in this industry. So I work with Joey Harrington, the former NFL quarterback, for his charity, the Harrington Family Foundation, where he comes out here to Kentucky and we pick a barrel. He takes it back and he auctions off the bottles to help send kids to college, things like that.
Dude, I tell you, man, I'm hooked on all the charity barrels. Like, I think it's such a cool thing. And I was fortunate enough to be in Edinburgh last year for the Distillers One of One, and just seeing how much money they raise and what it does to help people's lives. And that's from liquid that we enjoy drinking, talking about, collecting, whatever. But it's like that liquid changes people's lives.
Absolutely. And that's the sort of thing where it is just spirits at the end of the day. It's just whiskey. It is a social endeavor. Usually you go to a bar or you're at home with your family or crew and you're sharing a drink or two. But, if you can make it worth something a little bit more on the back end, I think it's important because there's a lot of money to spread around, and if you can help spread it around, help spread it around.
Well, it's just you don't realize how fortunate you are until you look at how many people are less fortunate and you're like, holy shit, it's not pretty out there. People are not born with anything. Forget about the silver spoon in their mouth or any of that. Like, they literally have to fight tooth and nail for everything that they have in life. So if you can get a spirit, and at the end of the day, a liquid that can help those people, it's pretty darn cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so that's the kind of my story is, again, 8 years in media, I think it's almost unprecedented at this point.
But so you coming in 2016, I mean, whiskey wasn't, it was about to pop. It had the head had just broken the water. Yes. Like there was nothing, it was like jumping in the pool and like just the top of your head's coming out above the water. Like, that's all that was happening. But before we jump into that, I kind of want to I always ask this question. Like, what was your first memorable experience with whiskey, like growing up? And it doesn't have to be like, oh my God, I drank the most amazing whiskey, but you're like, I'm going to drink whiskey. Was that your jam or?
I started off on wine and vodka. My grandfather introduced me to vodka at a tender age that I will discuss here. he was an old salt from Eastern Europe, so he always had a bottle of vodka in the freezer. In college, I remember getting handles of, back then, Austin Nichols, now Wild Turkey. But it was always recreational. There's no purpose behind any of that. You'd go to a bar and order a Jack and Coke and not really even think how Jack was. You know what I mean?
It was a financial equation, and you knew what happened. You knew what was going to happen. In South Africa, they drank a lot of tequila. So for me growing up, you're like, 50 cent tequila night. That sounds like a great idea to go to the bar.
What's tequila? Who cares?
Yeah, doesn't matter. I just know that it's 50 cents and it's going to make me feel big, tall, and strong.
So coming out of college, I did enjoy whiskey. Like, it was kind of my preferred drink. But it was more recreational. I wasn't in it for anything else. And then I went on a trip with my soon-to-be wife and her parents to Edinburgh. She's from Northern England, so we drove up for a weekend and stayed in a hotel. And my soon-to-be father-in-law and I were waiting at the lobby bar in the hotel. We went down to get a whiskey because we're in Scotland. What else are we going to do? I was at a bit of a loss. I mean, this is when I'm 23, 24, you know, something like that. And he's like, okay, I have to introduce you to Talisker. That's my favorite whiskey. That's what we're drinking. So we ordered a double dram of Talisker for each of us. And he sort of explained it to me, and, you know, that, you know, Isle of Skye and, you know, peated malt, Seaside, what he knew, the little he knew of it, because he was just a passive consumer. But that was his drink. He drank Talisker 10, period. That was the one whiskey he had in the house.
But it's kind of cool if you think about that, Zach. Somebody influenced him, that he had that tiny bit of knowledge that he was probably excited to share with you, that he knew something about his favorite drink, but, like, just enough to be dangerous.
Exactly. He had that little bit of information, and he was excited to share it with me, because it was a true bonding moment. I know that's kind of schmaltzy, but it was a true bonding moment between, you know, my future father-in-law and myself, and the excitement of being in Scotland for the first time, and I loved it. Like, I fell in love with Talisker right then and there, and it is still my preferred pour, though I've upgraded from the 10. And that was sort of the beginning. That was where I was like, okay, there's something actually here. This is interesting. Like, I had, because I had traveled so much by that point already, I had a fairly developed palate. So I could sort of recognize that there was more to this whole whiskey thing than just, you know, commodity and getting drunk for, you know, off handles of Wild Turkey. And then maybe a year or two later, I was living in Los Angeles going to film school. And one of my very good friends was living there as well. And he was the manager at Vendome Liquor Studios in the Lake, which is iconic liquor store.
Oh, I sell a lot of non-alc beer there. What are my brands?
There you go. Chicken.
Them in High Times still doing business like nobody's business.
Nice. So basically, he would like organize and lead the whiskey tastings that they would have there. You know, they had that like sidebar where they do wine tastings, beer tastings, whiskey tastings. And him and I on the weekends, you know, he'd bring all the open bottles home because he can't sell them. And he'd bring the open bottles home, and we'd play cribbage and play guitar and drink whiskeys. And he truly gave me an education where we would sit there, and this is going to sound so pretentious now, but at the time it wasn't. Be like, this is what Pappy Van Winkle is. This is what Black Maple Hill is. This is what A.H. Hirsch is and how they are connected. And, you know, this is what bourbon can be. This is what the people who are making bourbon, like White Label and Turkey, this is what they really make when they want to make something special. And like going through the nuances of, you know, how American whiskey can truly be something more than just a white or black label commodity product. And so that was like a year of just deep, almost inadvertent whiskey education of American whiskey.
Well, it's funny you say that analogy, and I was talking to someone the other day, and like, that was the Wagyu of whiskey before, like, the world Wagyu. Like, that's, you know, there was steaks, and then there was a Wagyu steak, and there was whiskey, and then there was that whiskey.
Exactly. And so I was extremely lucky, and this is like 07, 08, so this is a while ago. And so whenever I talk to my boy now, he's in Georgia now, and whenever we talk, we just sort of shake our heads and think of all the money we pissed away drinking those whiskeys. That's to say, in those bottles, because we were straight up opening A.H. Hirsch's and Black Maple Hills and stuff like that.
Yeah, but okay, but let's pause for a second. I mean, this is 2007, 2006. You know, if he paid more than $179 for a bottle, that was like highway robbery. So yeah. You're talking about stuff that was like $69.99 was like, are you sure you want to buy that? Oh, you know, I mean, I remember I was running restaurants and nightclubs in that time, and they would come and try to pitch me. I'm like, why the hell would I buy it? Like a $70 bottle of whiskey.
Right.
You can buy 40, turn it into like 40, you know, and Coke and soda and whatever. Like, I don't care, you know, make literally 20x my money and not have to worry about my people drinking it for free.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just it. Like, I vividly remember an A.H. Hirsch bottle having like a price tag of $59 or $69 on it.
Yeah.
And thinking like, but then you taste it and you're like, oh, I get it. I see. Okay. This is something more.
Think about that compliment. Like, think about our lives now when you taste multi-$1,000 bottles of whiskey. And like, I always go back to this. It's like, there's a cog on everything, you know, like, and the stuff that we drink, and like, think how the marketing is on such steroids, because, you know, let's just say to make a bottle of whiskey, you know, back then cost them $8 or $9, you know, and the liquid, you know, and now it might cost them 16, you know, with inflation and everything. And I'm being, you know, I'm not talking about like the crazy, but you like you think about the prices that get commanded now, and you sometimes just go like, whoa, like the cogs didn't go up that much to justify the end. You know, it's easy in other things perhaps to justify, oh, it's the weight of the gold, it's the diamonds, you know, that, but this is kind of like, I don't know, you know.
I mean, I do see, I see both sides of it, right? Like, I understand the inflated pricing on the secondary for, you know, things like a Pappy 23 or a BTAC Weller or something like that, especially if you're talking about a special vintage. Like, of course, that's going to be worth more. Just like, yeah, just like a Cosmo is going to be worth more than a Datejust if you're looking at watches, and a Supreme is going to be worth more than a Ye if you're looking at shoes right now. And it goes to any market, cars, art, everything has that.
Everything's worth what someone's willing to pay for it, right?
Right. On the
And
flip
that's what
side,
starts the thing.
if your MSRP is already $499, then I'm gonna have a raised eyebrow if you're not from Scotland. Because it's just, I know how long it takes to get $499 in Kentucky compared to how long it takes to get that $499 in the Highlands. You know what I mean? Like, we're talking
Yeah.
about decades difference here sometimes. And so
Yeah.
I do value, like, I think as well, there's a lot of value to be talked about in the people making those whiskeys, you know, the people who are on the bottle, people in the barrel houses, you know, the people in the offices making, you know, getting this stuff out. Then that kind of gets lost in the mix now because people are so focused on what they see on the shelf. They don't think about the thousands of people who touched every single bottle of whiskey from the people taking care of the trees in Missouri, to the lumberjacks, to the yards, to, you know, the transportation, to the grains, to the water, to the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, that's where I geek out when I go to these distilleries. Like, I want to peek behind all the curtains and talk to everyone there and be like, you know, the liquid's great, but I want to hear your story. Tell me what you know. You know, when I was in Scotland last year, I was just like, I was hanging out with the working people. Like, yeah, cool. I did the tour and all that kind of stuff. I'm like, that's great. I want to hear your history. Tell me, like, what's, oh, you know, my grandfather worked at this one and my father worked at this one. So naturally, this is what I was going to do or this. And I'm like, that's the excitement.
That's so exciting. Yeah,
The
I love that.
whiskey is kind of like the side effect of
Right,
all of
yeah.
that. You're like, whoa, and that's really good.
It's the residue of often multi-generations of labor and passion. And that's what I love
Passion.
about it. You know,
Passion, passion, passion.
yeah, I one of my favorite stories on earth, not because it's fancy or anything, but because it's so multi-generational and small and intimate, is Oban in Western Central Scotland. Technically, the Highlands on the sea. Seven people run that distillery plus the staff up front. And it's multi-generational. They've been working there for years and they have stories. Like, you'll be walking through talking, you know, with somebody who's working the grist mill. And it's like, yeah, my great great grandfather used to, you know, get a pitcher of beer out of the wash tun on his way home every night. And that was, you know, what they all did. And, you know, they can tell those stories of, you know, 100 years ago or 150 years ago or 200 years ago, because it's their people, it's their family, who they are, and they can hold on to that, and sort of that's what's being passed on to you in the bottle they're there to make. And that's what I love about it as well, is that sort of, it's, you get a little bit of that time machine aspect.
Well, like you talk to like people who worked on, with sherry or with cognac. They're like every Friday, you were offered to take as much as you could possibly take home
Yeah,
because we were
right.
overproducing what anybody wanted. Like there was nothing we could do about it. You know, that's the yield is 400 bottles, but people only want 250. We're not making 250. We're still making 400. That's the yield.
Well, and
You know,
that's,
like holy
yeah.
shit. You know, like and the whiskey, like you know, you're in Kentucky now. You go to any of them, they'd be like, yeah, Friday. They'd be like, hey, you know, take home a gallon. Take home 2 gallons if you want. Hey, it's somebody's birthday, take home 4 gallons. Knock yourself out. It's like, we don't have the demand for it. Now it's different, of
Now it's
course.
different. Yeah. Now it's funny.
So when, so 06, 07, you get an experience. You start tasting. Whiskey, like, is not anything really yet. You know, it's everything else is happening. 06, 07 was still very big into vodka and rums, if I remember correctly. Like there was a lot of mojitos being made
Oh,
and served and muddled everywhere, and vodka was still, you know, and there was, you know, Tanqueray was still Those were the staples. There wasn't whiskey on any bar or restaurant of significant quantity that anybody wanted because nobody wanted it. It was fine.
All clear. It was all clear all day. No brown sauce.
No, because brown was, you know, there was all that stuff. Well, if I drink brown, I go a little crazy and da 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 da. Yeah, it's like for me, I would drink a bottle of Johnnie Walker Black every Saturday night at my club because I really did it. People were like, I can't believe you drink that much. I'm like, first of all, when you drink that much, your body just acclimates to it. It's just what it is. But to me, it like kind of just kept me focused, but loose. And the biggest benefit, I always told people, why do you drink so much brown liquor? I'm like, because you don't have to go to the bathroom every 2 seconds. Right. Like, is this like, that was it? People are like, oh, you know, I drink beer. And I'm like, well, you know, like, I just, when you work in that environment, you can't be going to the bathroom as much as you need to. So brown was always my friend. Yeah. But like, it's crazy how I didn't have that experience of crazy, like now, like you say, you and your friend, you drank tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of whiskey and enjoyed it like it was meant to be. And people say that, and I'll take that from both sides. But like, it was just different. It was freely available. It wasn't a big stretch like it is now.
Exactly. That gave me a foundation. And you kind of fast forward till 2014 or so. I've been in Berlin for about 6 years. I was working in documentary film, always on the road, always going to film festivals, always, you know, either hearing pitches or pitching or, you know, getting money or begging for money. And I just sort of got burned out on that whole gambit.
Berlin got any kind of whiskey scene, or does it all work? Yes. And not
really? It really does. So Berlin low-key has one of the best cocktail scenes in the world and has for about, well, quarter of a century, really, truly, but 40 years. And we can get into that in a second. But a friend of mine who was also in documentary film got me a job at Victoria Bar, which is pretty much one of the top tier bars in Europe, cocktail bars. And I was very, very lucky in that I had that whiskey-based knowledge and that ability to understand palate and pairing. The owners, Stefan Weber and Beate Hindemann, who wrote The Art of Sophisticated Drinking and opened this bar and had a long lineage in cocktail mixing around the world and in Berlin, took me under their wing. And so for about the next 2 years, I was their, you know, student and learning very deeply about cocktail culture, about all spirits, about, you know, the business of cocktails, the industry. They got me going to BCB early, you know, Legacy with Bacardi, Mana Club, contests, like all those things I was in before I got into media. And so by the time Up Rocks rolled around with the lifestyle section, I already had a foothold in the industry side of the spirits world and on, you know, the front end service side. Well, it came to a point where you kind of come to a Y in the road, and you have, as a bartender, you have to choose, like, are you going to be a lifer or not? Because
yeah,
if you're a lifer, you have to make that choice and you have to go all in on the lifestyle. You can't pretend to have a dual lifestyle that you're going to have this normal everyday experience getting up at 7 with the kid and taking them to school and being there for soccer practice. Like, that's not the world of bartending.
No. I've got a buddy right now that's literally the 50-year-old door guy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, bro, you got 3 kids. Like, you know, and I would tell my staff at my restaurants, I'm like, don't be the 50-year-old bartender. Don't be the 50-year-old server. Like, learn, ask me. I'll teach you how to manage. Like, I'll give you a career.
Right. And that's just it. Like, I'm talking now 10 years ago almost. But so I was in my 30s and I was like, because I had, like, it was the sort of thing where it was like, okay, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to manage and I'm going to open my own place, right? Like, I'm not going to be a 50-year-old bar guy because I know exactly who you mean.
Huh.
And that's still a choice.
They're very happy. I mean, I know a 50-year-old doorman at a really big hotel here in San Diego. He does yoga. He surfs every day. He's single. Yeah. And so he wouldn't have it any other way. He eats the whole foods for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And he's all in.
Don't want my world just to be this world. I kind of wanted, you know, a little wider expanse. And so I basically pestered the editor of the lifestyle section of Up Rocks to give me a job via the comments section. You know, the rest is kind of history. But with that, Steve Bermucci, amazing editorial director of Up Rocks Life, you know, sort of like a brother from another mother sort of thing, same age, both from the Pacific Northwest, both amazingly well-traveled, but he had no real purchase in the drinks world. Like, travel world, amazing. Food world, amazing. Drinks, blind spot for him. So I sort of filled that blind spot in, and he, you know, he let me help him build the drinks section of Up Rocks over the years. And by 2019, early 2020, it kind of became clear that I needed to shift solely to whiskey, because that was my true passion. And then after that, I mean, we're talking 4 or 5 years later now, you know, it is where.
But I mean, okay, let's put a timestamp. We're going to timestamp 2016. Yamazaki Sherry Cask is about to get an award. No one's spoken about Japanese whiskey. Yeah. American whiskey exists, but, you know, like, people are still, even in 2016, are calling, like, Maker's Mark their fancy whiskey, their Johnny Walker Blue, if they're going to drink American whiskey. Scotch single malt is very much here in the country, very much global, but, like, no one, you know, is what it is. It's either, like, highfalutin snooting or it's nothing, you know, and everything in between. And every Glen and their mother, you know, has every airport lounge, every hotel, every bar, every restaurant has the same 6 or 7, you know, cast of characters.
Yes.
And that's only 8 years ago. I felt like after that Yamazaki Sherry Cask got, like, this all of a sudden, like, something different. I don't know why, but I feel like all of a sudden, all sails started getting lifted.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a road to that via Scotch, the whole world that had been created there with the high-end market and $100,000 bottles and stuff like that.
But you know, it was a secret society. You know, Dalmore was killing it with it. Only, you know, they all had the, like, they were all in Asia.
Yeah.
And like, they were like, dude, you want to go, you go to Singapore. That's where you go make your money. You go to China, you go make your money there. You're like, wait, what?
It was very much... Pacific Rim for sure. I think it was strange, right? Because it's booms and these waves where it's sort of like, was that really a boom or was it just really a moment? You know what I mean? Where Japanese whiskey had this moment for a second, then kind of went away again. Thinking about Scotch, I mean, people forget how new the idea of single malt is. I mean, even...
Correct. It was blends, and like, you were a weirdo if you did a single malt.
Yeah, like, literally, it was one in a million sort of thing. And, you know, you go back to even historical labels, trying to find a single malt from before 1960, you're going to have a hard time.
You talk to guys that'll be like, well, yeah, we were in, you know, you've been in Scotland. Like, we were in business to supply Diageo with components for their blends.
Yeah, exactly.
Which anymore? It's like, yeah, we had a fully functioning distillery. Did you make any Evian stuff? Yeah, I mean, we did, of course. Our people took them home, but we waited for that phone call from, you know, the boys at Johnny Walker Blue to be like, hey, can we buy some? Yeah, exactly. What you got? Hey, can you? I mean, and it wasn't clear to me until last year or the year before, where they did a deconstruct of one of the Johnny Walker Ghost and Rare, and you realize just how many distilleries go into that bottle?
Oh yeah, it's mind-boggling. Well, that's what it did. Like, you know, you think about it. Like, there's 145 distilleries in Scotland, or 135, whatever the number is, somewhere in there. 145. I dare anybody to name all of them. Because there's I would say there's still probably 30-40%. That are doing that, where, like, they don't have their own single barrel product or single malt product or single grain product. If they do, it's in the gift shop only, and there's a case of it, and
the gift shop's only open on Friday and Saturday,
exactly, for 2 hours, that rest, and they're probably pumping out untold amounts of whiskey, and it's all either going to Chivas or it's all going to Diageo.
and it was funny because, like, you know, I'm close with, you know, and I spent time talking just the Gordon MacPhail and the whole family history. So I was having dinner with Stephen last trip, and he was just like, yeah, you know, like, obviously our grandfathers and our dads, like, they would just show up and be like, hey, what you got? And they would show up in some very big name places that now, you know, are very big name. And they would be like, please take as much as you can. Like, you need to buy it.
Right.
Like, you just need to buy it. I mean, you know, the stuff that you hear, like you do and I do when you're in the industry, you're like, holy shit, I can't believe that they sold it to you, a G&M or one of the independent bottlers. They're like, well, everyone needs money.
Yeah.
You know, well, like, that's it.
I think that's what sort of what I like in the industry that's, or in Scotch especially, that's come back around is that where you have the compass boxes. And I mean, Barry Brothers and Red have been there forever, so they've always been. But you know what I mean? But they become popular again, where it's like, you know, it's okay for these bottlers to go out in these blending houses and get a whole bunch of amazing stuff from all over and make something new, because that's how it is kind of meant to be if you look back historically, right? You know, the whole grocery store idea where they just get barrels from wherever you want, and the grocery manager puts together his blend, and that's that blend. And that's your whiskey. Yeah. You know, nobody was getting a single barrel or a single malt or a single grain. They're like, no, I wanted the blend that, you know, the guy I love down the street makes. And it's come back around to that in a small way. I kind of love it because it's not more interesting. It's interesting, and it adds so much more to the conversation that was there and was so hyper regional and local, like where literally, you know, every grocery store had a different blend of whiskey in it. You know, it's nice to be moving back towards that. And it also, you know, obviously with Compass Box, you can get just as highfalutin as you want with that because they have $500 bottles too. But, you know, you get a Glasgow artist for 50, 30 bucks, you know, like they span the whole spectrum, which is great.
Well, he did a good job. I mean, I am curious, you know, obviously the announcement that he's, you know, moving on, you know, John, you know, I used to call him, you know, like the Willy Wonka of whiskey. Like,
yes.
Can't go for it. Like, he was just that quirky and that out there. And I've had many a good drinks and conversations. I'm like, he just was, you know, it was an FU to start, but yeah. He kind of knew that, like, he knew how good he was. He knew. But so he had, like, that pocket ace up his sleeve. And he's like, all right, like, I'm going to push society here as much as I can, but I kind of know I'm going to nail it. And he did.
Even then, like, there's no way Diageo would have put a Cameron Bridge single grain in their special love beer.
Not a chance.
At Compass Box, not put so much of their juice into their blends and made it so popular. Because never, or Rose Isle. Like, they put a Rose Isle on that. And it's like, what? Really?
Well, and then, you know, you're now starting to see of the 145, you know, coming out, you know, like, it's just like, it's beautiful to watch.
Yeah, like, that's great.
For me, it'd be like when I was, you know, on this last trip, like, just in some random bar, you know, up in the middle of nowhere, that I had an issue with my cell phone, and I was like, I don't fucking have anyone's phone number. Like, I'm screwed. Like, what do I do? How do I get out of here? Like, I don't know what to do. This phone is my only thing, and I'm like, I'm drinking, like, 1965 Linkwoods.
Right.
Like, sitting there. You know, Royal Brocklas, you know, like from the 60s, yeah. You know, and I'm just like, wait, what? Like, considering where I'd been a few days before, where like they were designed to take the money, this little bar that I was at was not designed. So they were like, yeah, that's like, oh, you want to just do a half pour? Yeah, that's like 10 bucks.
Yeah.
You wanna do that? And great. I'm like, yeah, so I can have this entire flight from the 1960s for like $90 with like a 30% gratuity, you know, compared to this other amazing place that I was at, where it was like starting for what I want to drink was like $2,500 an ounce.
Right.
And I'm like, well, in America, it would be 10 grand because they would never have this. So like, exactly. This is one of those like lifetime moves. I'm like, I want the experience. I want to, because it's just different. The stuff from back in the day, and it's no diss on the stuff today.
No,
it was just different. Those people were different. They weren't as many computers. I was with Harlan 2 years ago at Buffalo Trace. I said, what's different in the whiskey in your 30 whatever years? And he's like, the whiskey you're drinking now, Gavin, is the cleanest whiskey, because like literally we poke and prod that liquid all day long to make sure there's no impurities, no this, no that, no this. It's the cleanest thing that like ever that you're drinking.
Yeah. And I don't know if I'm a fan of that. Like
my analogy, Zach, was like, hey, you can cook on a nonstick pan.
Yeah.
Or you can use your trusty griddle that you've had there forever that's seasoned and everything going on. Eh, I don't know. Yeah.
Exactly.
I want to throw my steak in the other one, not the nonstick. They're both going to cook my steak.
Oh, yeah. And that's just it, man. Like, I look at, you know, I kind of feel like this is the Japanese influence a little bit, in that everything is pristine. Everything is, you know, spotless. Everything is exactly right. Obviously, a lot of computerization came from that scene. But it's the same thing. You know, it goes down to, you know, you pop open a, you know, an old Grandad 114 from the early 70s that was made in National, you know, which is now Castle and Key, Old Taylor, whatever it is. And it's not just the dirtiness of the seasoned stills or the vats, or it's the fact that the wood was completely different wood. Like a 100 oak tree that was turned into a barrel in 1969 was alive in 1869. You know, like that's just a different era. The grains are different because back then they only pulled in grains from local farmers because that's all they needed to pull in. They didn't have to bring in, you know, North Dakota wheat or Minnesota corn or on, you know, Northern German rye. Like that never happened back then. What they did, what they made was how much they could make by what was being grown around the distillery in Kentucky or Indiana or Ohio, wherever they were, you know, distilling. And so it's a completely different grain you're making. You know, the yeasts have evolved over time. Like, you know, Jim Beam is very proud that, you know, they still have Booker's yeast, but yeast evolves. Like it's the same yeast, yeah, but that yeast is not the same yeast.
Anytime I see Black Adder out there, I'll always grab. I mean, of all the bottles of my, that I have open in the house, I'd say of a string of one person, it's Black Adder because, like, he don't give a shit. Robin's just pouring it from the barrel into the glass, and that's it. Good luck. Okay, God be with you. I hope it's going to be okay. You know, enjoy yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, yeah, and that's, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate where whiskey has come. Like, don't get it wrong. There are amazing, amazing, amazing whiskeys being made right now.
Well, you told a story earlier with your father-in-law and your wife, you know, she growing up. Like, if you think just in that time period, it's highly unlikely in that moment that your wife was drinking whiskey. But today, pretty sure, you know, my wife never drank whiskey until she met me. And now she'll drink, you know, a Michter's 10 rye and act like she's been drinking rye whiskey her whole life.
Right, of course.
And, you know, it's like I feel like all of this has just brought more people in, so whiskey didn't have to be this like singular sport. It's now like a team sport.
And this has always been true, but it's always been kind of there's always been something for everybody the whole time. Like, you know, even if you want to get granular about, you know, the difference between in the 1950s, the difference between a Four Roses or a Heaven Hill. Like, there was something for everybody back then, too. And it's like, you know, the difference between a Talisker and an Oban or a, you know, a Macallan and a Singleton. Like, all those are different. There's the 143 or 140 whatever distilleries in Scotland. Every one of them is going to have something different for somebody. And they're going to have something different within that as well. Like, go to Jimmy's.
Because that's that person's pride. That's that person's pride statement. Well, I'm not just another me too. We do this or we did that, you know, like, that's the coolness. And I think going back to our comment about the blends, like that's when it gets fun, when someone takes all of that magic and mixes it together and makes something super magical.
Yes. Yeah. That's what gets exciting. It's sort of, and you see that, you're starting to see that a little bit come back in the US with American blended whiskey. And, you know, you have people actually, Bourbon Pursuit's great at doing this, or Pursuit Spirits, bringing whiskeys from other states, putting them together. Obviously, Barrel Craft Spirits is doing this as well. And they're doing really well, where they're bringing a whole bunch of different whiskeys from all over, like sometimes in Canada as well, and putting them together to make something so much bigger and better than the singular parts. And that's exciting. I feel like that's an exciting time to be in. I think more people should be doing it. Does that mean I think there should be less, you know, small batch or single barrels? Of course not. God, no.
No.
So much room and so much space to do stuff. Where, you know, your imagination is the only limit. And
I mean, did you in 2016 think that when you first started with Uproxx, there's no way you foresaw any of this, right?
It was definitely on the right. I think coming from the industry on the service side, but also like BCB and stuff like that on cocktails, because cocktails had, like, they were already coming off a peak at that point, right? Because you had huge resurgence in the late aughts with, you know, Morgenthaler in New York and you know, London and Berlin.
Yeah, but you remember working in it. Like, it took, like, it went to that point where you're like, do I want to spend literally 4 to 6 minutes making a drink? Right. Or do I just want to give this person a $50 scotch? I closed that deal in 17 seconds, including putting the bottle back on the shelf.
It was.
I didn't have to clean out all my stuff every 7 seconds, you know, all my bar tools to make that next cocktail.
I think by the second cocktail wave in the 2010s, mid-2010s, here's the difference, and you probably remember this as well. Here's the difference between a mid-aught cocktail bar and a mid-teened cocktail bar. The mid-aught cocktail bar would maybe have 30 total bottles from every category. A mid-teen cocktail bar would maybe have 300 bottles from every category.
Yeah.
Because single malts came in, single barrels came in, small batch came in, age statements came back. All this is coming back, obviously.
Yeah.
It's not like there was a Knob Creek in the fucking 80s and 90s. You know what I mean? Where it's like suddenly what we learned in the mid-aughts in the cocktail scene was that, oh, we could act, better booze will make better cocktails. Let's forget everything in the 90s and 80s that destroyed cocktail making with the commoditization and the syrups and the cutting corners and the
bags on the guns. Like, oh, you can order. I used to go to the Vegas, you know, show, and they'd be like, you can make that cocktail now in like no second. Just same as you did with Coke, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper. You just squeeze the button, add vodka, boom, Cosmopolitan.
Done. God, I remember those days. That was it. It was like the mid-aughts were that bridge, right? Where it's like, oh, we can bring all the fruit and the real things back to the bar. And then by the mid-teens, it was like, oh, we can also bring all the bottles back. And so I feel like by the mid-teens, there was an inkling of like, okay, this is going to keep going. Because I do remember people would come in and ask for a specific whiskey in their cocktail. It never happened in the aughts, in the early 2000s. And
it's still happening now. I tell people like, oh, old fashioned, I only have it with this. And, you know, whiskey sour, I only have it with this. I'm like, you really know the difference? Or you just want to pay extra. I don't know. Your call.
I think it's for the latter. But, you know, but then again, some people, they dial that shit in. You know, they had it somewhere else and they want to recreate it at their next experience. And that's great. But I do specifically remember a sort of shift there where it was like, suddenly someone was coming in and it's like, you know, I want an Edinburgh Sour. Please make it with Laphroaig 10 and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, okay, this person, you had to have that stuff on hand when somebody came in and ordered an Old Fashioned with Michter's 10 or an Old Fashioned with Abalor, Abunda or something like that, you know.
40 minutes faster than lightning. And I got to wrap it up, but I got to ask the magical question and we'll do this again. Is there any experiences that you like that have happened in this whiskey passion path that you want to like pinch yourself? Like, I can't believe I'm doing this.
Wow. There's so many.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. I know. I feel the same way. So like, I know this is a challenging one, but like, and you know, it could be early. You pick that moment where you like, literally, if you got a mirror in front of you, like a pretty fucking good day to be me.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of, I always try to think of the most recent things because it just always gets better and better and better. I mean, I could talk about barrel picks or bottle kills or what have you. But the two most recent things that come to mind, one was I went on a bourbon lore trip with friends of mine, Mason Walker, Emerson Shawwell, Clay Risen. We were down in Arizona, Scottsdale, staying at an amazing hotel. We took a plane, flew over the Grand Canyon. And then on the edge of the Grand Canyon, we opened Age here, shared it all around, killed the bottle. Went back, had an amazing dinner, a great sort of just like social gathering in a villa at the hotel to build more. And, you know, Pablo Moya was there opening up his, you know, rare characters.
Love Pablo.
And, you know, Zev was there opening up $100-year-old bottles from Sotheby's. And, you know, like, the whole crew was there sort of thing. You know what I mean? Where you were drinking, you know, whiskey that was bottled 100 years ago that was 20 years old, and you're drinking, you know, one of my favorites is, you know, Old Fitz 64. You know, I got to kill a bottle of that. It was just also the experience of being around people who enjoy this level of whiskey, but somehow aren't pretentious about it. And it was just as much about the food and the socializing. And, you know, Mason Walker, very, very amazing at hosting, you know, he brought in indigenous dancers for entertainment, and he brought in an indigenous silversmith to make jewelry for us, and hand paint posters. And it was one of those things where after a few days, you're sitting on the plane coming back home. I don't know how you even begin to top that, like, or like what even is life anymore? You know, you're sort of Like, how do you go on? Because it's this thing, and then you realize, like, oh, we'll just go meet you in Miami, and we'll do it all again. So it's that sort of life where, that's obviously a very elite experience, but an experience anybody can join in on. I got home and I was telling my wife about it, and she's like, yeah, that sounds about right. Like, you've been working for, over 10 years to do this, and so of course you should be there. Like, this is what your life is. This is what all your experiences leading up to has led up to. And it's sort of the thing where it's like,
100%, and she's spot on. And
yeah, I
there's got to
remember.
be, like for me, this isn't, the Rolex whiskey thing is a passion project. It came out of the fact that my kid was born 5 weeks premature in a hospital with, for 2 weeks in a NICU. And my buddy was like, "Hey, we can't get whiskey in Detroit. Can you help me get some? Because the allocation sucks." And I was like, wait, how much are you making on this thing?" He's like, "Oh, like 5x." I'm like, "How about I just start like an alternative investment strategy, the kids' college fund? What's the worst case scenario? You drink it." And then it became real money. But then Rolex whiskey, just by sheer consistency, people are like, "How do you post every day?" I'm like, "Dude, there's some days I do not want to post, but I got to muster it up because like it's what I do." And then the experiences that we get to have. So your wife's spot on, because my wife says the same. I come home, I tell her about these trips, and she's like, her normal thing is like, "Why don't you take me with?" I'm like, "Babe, we have never done that. I'm not going to start now because like it's a whole different world in there." And so I'm like, "Hey, babe, are you okay? Hey, babe, do you want to leave? Hey, like, I don't want any of that. Like, I like to just
I like to eat a hot
disappear
pepper. Like, yeah.
into my own little world with my own little friends and experience the moment and not worry about anybody." And she gets that. But it's like, it's the work that gets us into these rooms to do it. We're not just like, yeah, there are people that just pay their way in, and it's like, it's awkward and they're very nice people and all that kind of stuff. And I'm kind of like, yeah, this is like a Thursday afternoon for all the hard work I've put in over the last 8 years, to get to this point and be like, yeah, there's are those moments where you, like you said, you're flying home on the plane, like, and you're like, "Holy shit, did I just do that? Be fucking nuts. That was cool. I wonder what I can do next." Like, I wonder what it's gonna look like. Because these moments don't end. It's not like this is it. It's just like it gets more exciting. Like Pablo will come to my house and we'll crack like nothing crazy, but his palate's like nuts. So I like sit there just staring at him like, "Wait, so what did you get on that one?" And he's like, "Blah, blah, blah." I'm like, "Fuck, bro. That was just a really good scotch." Like to me, like I didn't get the black currant that you found under the strawberry jam in the back left corner of my mouth. Didn't see it. But like, hey, you got it. We crushed it today. I definitely want to talk more. I
Oh,
can't
for
thank you
sure.
enough for coming on. Do you want to put your socials again? Just how to follow you on Instagram and all that good stuff.
So you can follow me on Instagram at ZTP Whiskey. If you put in ZTP, I'll probably come up if you know Gavin. And you can follow me on uprocks.com. I'll post there one or two articles a day during the week
That's
that are
amazing.
whiskey reviews. And so, I'm reviewing whiskey constantly. If you saw my house, you would wonder why my wife is with me, because it is literally covered in bottles and samples right now. I have to get that more organized. But so I'm constantly re reviewing whiskey. I'm going to be in San Francisco next month judging, London in May. But yeah, so you'll see a lot of that content coming up on my Instagram to follow and see what that lifestyle is like. And Gavin, I just want to say thank you for the invitation, and can't wait till we talk next
Oh,
time.
dude, unbelievable, man. Thank you. Everyone, please follow Zach. Like, he's doing it, man. And this is real. Like, there's so much education and so much passion. It's beautiful to see. So everyone, definitely follow everything. Thank everyone for listening. Seriously, love you guys. Just gonna keep having fun. I can't believe we're on like episode 60 already or something like that. Like, definitely Zach, I can't imagine what it's like doing two articles a day. I have a hard enough time scheduling one interview per week that we've been keeping. So
Right, it's hard. You just gotta do the work. Sometimes you don't want to post, but you gotta post, you know.
you gotta post, man. It's a people, you know what? You see the thanks. You see the people go like, "Whoa, I didn't know that." Like that's the moment. Like you, when you're feeling that moment, like you'd probably deal with it all the time where you're like, "Ah, I've done a lot." And someone comes up like to you, "I love what you're doing." You're like, that just erased like 100 shitty thoughts that were going through my head, like that I've got a lot going on. All right, I'm recharged. Let's go.
Exactly.
Until next time, everybody, I appreciate everybody, and that's it. It's a wrap.